It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. My most recent column for the Westchester Guardian can be found on the website www.westchesterguardian.com. It is the 142nd column in the Creative Disruption series. But I hope you'll read the columns, enjoy them, and if need be, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And John Mack is johnmack13@gmail.com. You will find links to the previous radio shows and to my new online daily newspaper at my web home. Try the newspaper and subscribe. It's only one email per day. And that email and that website is www.johnmack13.com. And now to this show. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. I do hold the on-air participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest next week on this show will be columnist, founder of Salon, and MSNBC contributor Joan Walsh. My guest tonight is scheduled to be the well-known novelist Sarah Paresky. I first met Sarah, if met is the correct word, 30 years ago when I read her first book, Indemnity Only. And since then, I have read each of her books. It was only recently, when reading her most recent, Critical Mass, that I was blown away by the accuracy of her portrayal of events in my field, technology, and also found that she had referenced Turing's Cathedral, the book by George Dyson, which I coincidentally was reading at the exact time. So I contacted Sarah and found out that we had more things in common. For instance, George's sister Esther is a friend and the past guest on this show, while Sarah's husband, the physicist, worked on projects with George's father, the famed and still active of Freeman Dyson. In addition, when I began reading Sarah's work, the only female writers of mystery that were well known, at least to me, were Dorothy Sayers and Agatha Christie. Due not only to Sarah's writing, but also to her work in an organization that she founded, Sisters in Crime, many of the best known mystery writers today are female. We can name those. There are Patricia Cornwell, Linda Fairstein, Sue Grafton, Laura Littman, Kathy Righteous, Sue Grafton, who I already mentioned, because her first work began at the same time at Sarah's in 1982. Julius Spencer Fleming and Lisa Scott Leon. Sarah has not yet joined us. Sarah has an ill husband. I hope that that's not the reason that she's not here. And she's also heading to Vancouver this week. I don't know whether either of these are the reason or the fact that she is in a different time zone and misread the Eastern time. So, in the meantime, I will speak a bit about her. And if she shows up, that's terrific. And if she doesn't, then we'll do something else. Sarah was born in Ames, Iowa, but she grew up in Kansas. She went to the University of Kansas, where she majored in political science. She then worked in Chicago as a community service. And And then she went back to school, graduating with a PhD in history from the University of Chicago. She also has an MBA from the University of Chicago. She married the well-known physicist from the university, and she began to work with an insurance company. After 10 years in the insurance company, she tried a hand at writing. She took a course with the well-known mystery writer, Stuart Kaminsky, at the University of Chicago in writing detective fiction. He was taken with her work, and he sent her first novel to his agent. It took the agent a year to shop it, but once he did, it was extremely successful. She's maintained the same characters throughout all of her books, with the exception of two non-mystery books. And she's presently just completed her 14th book in the series, and they're all set in Chicago. The heroine is a the detective V.I. Wasiszkowski, to whose name I just butchered, and she's built a lot around this. This character, all different things relating to Chicago and Chicago history. It's extremely interesting that when she and Sue Grafton both came to press in 1982, and since then they've had both many books. As most of the listeners know, Sue Grafton had her has the A is for Alibi, B is for This, and she's presently up to W. But their characters have not aged. And it's interesting in the way they've approached it. Sue Grafton continued her series, all set in the same 1982 time frame that her character was dealing with. So she might have aged a year or 2 years, but it's all in the same period. Whereas Peretsky's characters, they did not age either, but she's kept her stories contemporary. So her present story that I just read, Critical Mass, is set in the present. And if you're not looking for this, as I have not been, and I, as most people that know me, read a lot, you don't notice it. I didn't notice it. But it's a very different way of handling this aging process. In Critical Mass, she goes into a number of extremely interesting and controversial things. Number one, it begins dealing with some documents relating to childhood friends of her aunt, who came over here prior to the Germans taking over. She had relatives that went to England and then came over here, and it deals with the Holocaust and subsequently something called Operation Paperclip. An Operation Paperclip was a program where the United States brought Nazi scientists here to the United States. Now most of us know that Wernher von Braun came over here, and Wernher von Braun always swore that he was not a Nazi. He was just doing what he had to. But according to what comes out of the book, is that there were many more ex-Nazis here. And she documents that well. She also takes us through some of the history of the British and the United States technological effort, starting with Alan Turing's Enigma, all the way through the development of the atomic bomb. And she bases some of the research on the aforementioned George Dyson book. I really think that this is her best book to date, and it's a testimony to her skill that 30 years after her first published book, which was 10 years after her graduation from with the PhD, so we're talking 40 years down the pike, that she's turning out what at least I consider her best effort. She did take two books, two breaks from the mystery series. I had planned to ask her what led her to do that. There was two other books. One has to do with the history of Kansas, and there was also the movie made from her from one of her mysteries, where Kathleen Turner starred as her heroine. And to her heroine, I will spell the name. It's V period I period W A S H S H A W S K I. Barbara McMullen, who has some Polish ancestry, pronounces it much better than I do, and she's been drilling me into pronunciation, which obviously didn't work. I would call it Wojcicki, and that may be correct. So I don't think that Kathleen Turner did a very good job in the movie. What I will do while I try to contact her is first I'll play a little music, and we'll go on and we'll do some other things. I shall be right back. And we will now, and I just sent her a message, so we're going to see how that works out. But in the meantime, there's two things that I'm going to do, and they both relate to my own poetry. The first poem that I ever had published, and it probably ruined me, because it finished fourth place in the national contest. And I didn't expect that, but the once I did, I felt that I had to keep writing, and I wound up publishing on Amazon new and collected poems by John MacDebard, and there's 110 of them, so I didn't stop right away. But the first one was called Cashing a Check, and it starts off, I saw this wonderful line in a column in a motorcycle magazine: the mind writes checks that the body can't cash. The vision that many from my old neighborhood have of me is short and thin, with the Pepsi in one hand and the cigarette in the other. Others will remember me a bit later as tall and thin, hitting a jumper from the corner or throwing the no-look pass to a cutter. Others will picture me at the end of the bar in the broad snow, with an open pack of Pall Malls and a half-finished beer on the bar, Don Gibson's I Can't Stop Loving You on the jukebox. Pat, one more when you get a chance, please. Age has taken the jumper. Diabetes has taken a Pepsi. Common sense has taken the cigarette and booze. I am older and wiser and hopefully more tolerant. I am satisfied with my life, but to just be able to once more fake the man guarding me, go up for a jumper and get nothing but net, to be able once more to cash that check. Now, I'm having knee surgery next week, and it's not major surgery. It's taking out some dead cartilage around my knee, but I don't have the speed that I used to. I have bad knees and some problems with my hips. So I wrote something called Wheels, and it's Wheels, as many may know, is a term that's used in sports for legs. He's got good wheels, means that he can move rather rapidly. My wheels are shot. I'm hobbling all over. I used to fly down the field under a pass, drive hard for the basket, take the extra base. I wasn't the fastest guy in the world, but I could run, and my wheels got me off the ground for a pass or rebound, and now they can't. Do you use your feet for other things? For walking, for sex, for swimming, for a hell of a lot of things. I want my wheels back. So I went over to my orthopedist, and I wound up writing another poem called Wheels 2. I got in the car and drove to the medical center. Then hobbled to my orthopedist's office. I said, fix my wheels, please. So he x-rayed, poked and prodded, and finally pressed up until I screamed and leaped. He said, I thought so. You've got plantar fasciitis. Wow, how did you treat that? I'll send you over to the podiatrist, and he'll fix you for inserts. That should help. Great, but how long will the whole thing take? Under a year. Shit. So off I go. The new doctor finds an ingrown toenail that must be cleaned out to prevent infection. Painful son of a bitch. Then it's a cortisone shot for the plantar fasciitis and an appointment for feet molds. Then I'm gone. Less pain, more depression, but also joy that could be a hell of a lot worse. One more with age, and then I'll go back looking for Sarah. It's called Senior Benefits. When I was young and foolish, and the New York drinking age was 18, I often drank in bars at 16 and 17. It's not that I looked older. I certainly didn't. The bartenders just looked the other way. In fact, I was caught in New Jersey when the age was 21, and I was 26. This morning, I drove through a Dunkin' Donuts line and ordered the largest coffee they sell. The very polite young voice said, "That'll be $2.03." I drove to the window and taking the coffee, said 203, right? I can speak in numbers. She said, "No, there's a special discount for you." I immediately thought I must have been the millionth customer through, or was deemed the handsomest man of the day. Instead, she said, "It'll be $1.94. There is the senior citizen discount. You're a senior, aren't you?" If she hadn't been so nice, I would have said, "Keep your fucking 9 cents. Just give me the coffee." Instead, I waited, nodded, and then gave her $2, then waited for change. And now we'll go back to another of my favorite songs that I have on here.
Life's true meaning comes to you, and the freedom you seek is one. Peace is for everyone. Peace is for everyone. Peace.
Although some will be disappointed, we go back to the poetry. I'm going to stay with the knees. Visit to the orthopedist, who's also an old basketball buddy. We began with x-rays, pelvis and hips, and then we'd sit down to talk. about the pains in my hips, about the pains in my thighs, about the pains in my knees, about the pains in my calves, about the pains in my shins. And it's decided, one, I should have the new bed. It won't happen. My wife loves this one. But I have arthritis in my knees and stairs will continue to be a bitch. I have a very weak right ankle. I have something called piriformis syndrome, therapy and exercise are called for. Some of the various conditions are probably caused by back problems related to compression of the knees. Compression of the back, rather. How old are you? Soon to be 70. Well, these things happen when you get older. You're probably shorter than you were. That's part of the back problem. Measure yourself. I don't feel shorter. I'm still a good deal taller than most of my friends. Hell, maybe they're shorter, too. So it looks like I'm in for E&E, exercise, and endure. As I leave, he smiles and says, that's what you get after years of abuse. So I guess the body isn't warranted for more than 100,000 jump shots. And Irish voice. I used to get angry, or at least perturbed, when my wife of Philadelphia birth and German-Polish heritage. That was a nasty combination of which neither family approved, but the union producer goddess would refer to me as Irish. I'm not Irish, I would bellow. I'm American. The Irish killed each other for religious reasons, used the feast of a Catholic saint as an excuse to get drunk and foolish, as if they needed an excuse, and were just generally disreputable. I refused to agree on St. Patrick's Day and generally disavowed my heritage. I knew little of this heritage other than the fact that the British had overrun them and made them part of the empire, but they have done that to the Canadians, Australians, Indians, and they hadn't become objects of joke and ridicule. I didn't understand the difference between the Revolution and the Civil War. In short, I might as well have been a Brit. Of course, I grew up in an Irish neighborhood. Thank the maker that my four grandparents had got on the boat for Ireland, drank in all the bars, listened to Ruthie Morrissey sing Songs of Rebellion at Mickey Carton's Mayo House in Rockaway, then behaved like the rest of the mix. It was only when I began to read the poetry and literature of Moore, Singh, Yeats, and Thomas that I began to feel the culture that already flowed through my veins. When I read Bernadette Devlin writing of the present day economic inequities, my anger boiled. And when I read the works of the McCourts, I began to understand from whence I came. So, if you're not Irish, I respect your heritage, but I'm sorry for your troubles. That's an interesting line, by the way. I'm sorry for your troubles. And this is not part of a poem, but it's what the Irish tend to say to people at a wake. They'll go up to the widow and they'll say, I'm sorry for your troubles, rather than I'm sorry that that guy's in the coffin. And it's an expression that I've always thought was fairly humorous. And in reading Mary Higgins Clark's autobiography, which is terrific, by the way, and she's a terrific woman. I got to interview her about 30 years ago. She talked about how the chief and her husband used to laugh at that, I'm sorry for your troubles line. And when her husband became terminally ill, his mother was always there, and his mother had always wanted to die before her son. And then the husband died, and the mother died immediately of a heart attack. So Mary Higgins Clark had a double wake. Obviously, a terribly heart-rending thing. And some fella came up to her and said, I'm sorry for your double troubles. And she went hysterical laughing. And she thought that the people in the funeral parlor must have thought she had lost her senses. Hell, I would have gone hysterical laughing, too. Growing up, in an apartment house in Inwood. And at that time, children went out to play by themselves. And now they lock parents up. They send kids out with a ball at the age of 8 or 10 to go play in the park. Well, I lived on an upper floor. So, and I've described this in talking to elevators. I started talking to my elevator when I was about 6. I was lucky. Many of my friends didn't even have elevators. Over the years, I've talked to many elevators and cars and, of course, motor scooters, but only when alone. They've been a great help. They listen attentively, and best of all, they don't talk back. And we will once again go to music. I mentioned bars earlier. I grew up in Inwood. It was the very northern tip of Manhattan Island, and there were more bars in that neighborhood than any in New York City. Walter Winchell called it Ginwood during the heydays of Walter Winchell. So I wrote a little thing about it called The Bars. I grew up in an Irish Jewish neighborhood. The Jewish lads went to school and studied. The Irish went to the bars. To be sure, many of us also went to school and played sports without girls. No sex, though. But we went to the bars, underage, after games, after dates, after softball games, before and after dances, to watch the Sunday football game, and for every other damn reason. The Broadstone, the Willow Tree, Aaron Zile, Chambers, McSherry's, Inwood Lounge, Dark Fiddlers, Cassidy's, Jimmy Ryan's, Keenan's Corner, Dolan's, The Pig and Whistle, Free Hills, Terminal, Old Schilling, Markey's, McGoldrick's, Comore, Rooney's, Grippo's, Minogue's. Well, you get the idea. We know the bartenders by name: George Lynch, Pat Gallagher, Sunshine, Georgie Costello, Chris, Fred, Tommy, Mara, John, Joe, Kathy, and Aaron's. And they all bought back. The next one's on me, Mac. And you never leave after a buyback. We hung out there. We talked. We laughed. We sang. We sometimes fought. But we drank. And we didn't just drink in the bars. We drank in the park. We drank at parties. We drank at football games. We drank at dances from a hidden flask. Many slowed down as they grew up. Many stopped altogether. And some were stopped only by the grave. The drink was the macho factor. If you told a fellow if he had diabetes, he'd stop taking sugar. If you told some of my friends they shouldn't drink, they'd say, "What do you mean? I can hold my liquor." They planned to drink until they died, and they did. I still think we had more fun than the Jewish guys, unless they were getting laid. We start to think of why are we here? Why? And I wrote a poem, Damned If I Know. I find myself ending more than one poem with the words, Damned If I Know. But upon reflection, I realize how many facts that I know and how little I really understand about the things that matter. I know who played third base for 1927, 1939, and 1949 Yankees. Who developed the first spreadsheet? Who played Matt Dillon on the radio? Who held the New York Knicks single-game scoring record before Bernard King? What the first graphic browser? Who wrote Sincerely? Who played the leprechaun in the original Finian's Rainbow? And who replaced Clyde McFadden, who was the lead singer of the Dominoes? Yet, I cannot say for sure if there really is a God, whether or not there is an afterlife. Whether there will ever be true peace in the world, then really, what's the purpose of my life? So I know a lot and understand very little. I moved on from Inwood to go in the Army for a while, down to and I had never seen real racial institutionalized prejudice. We lived in the neighborhood that I lived in, as I mentioned, was Irish, Catholic, Jewish. I didn't know that there were things called Protestants until one of them started to hang around with us. And it was only years later that I understood there were many kinds of Protestants, Episcopalians, and Methodists, and Presbyterians. But even though there were no blacks or Hispanics in the neighborhood, we knew about Harlem and we knew about other places, and it just seemed as though people stayed where they were with other people that were like them. There was no rule, there was no thing codified that you couldn't move to another neighborhood, and that happened later. But then I went in the Army, and I was in Lawton, Oklahoma in 1963, which is the name of the poem. I was in the Army at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, in what seemed a colossal waste of time. But in retrospect, was really a very important part of my life. The town adjacent to Fort Sill, Lawton, had no industry. But it did have bars, clip joints, hookers, and whatever else could separate a soldier from his money. It also had an Indian section, a Mexican section, a black section, a white soldier section, and a white real people section. In New York City, we had neighborhoods, Italian neighborhoods, Irish neighborhoods, Jewish neighborhoods, black neighborhoods. But we never thought of New York City segregated. Maybe we should have. But Lawton was definitely segregated. Anyway, my platoon had an IG inspection. That's a big deal. And did exceptionally well. My platoon sergeant, the very sharp soldier who I respected, gathered us together and said, "I'm proud of you. You did very well. The supply sergeant and I just bought a bar a mile out of town. Come on down. The first one's on me. No dope he. If we started drinking tomorrow from nowhere, we were there to stay. Does anyone knowing us might expect a Warren from the old neighborhood and I were the first ones to arrive? I was into about my third beer when Bob, also from Inwood, walked in with two other folks, both black. The bartender saw me greet them and said to me, "I can't serve those folks." It was obviously that he meant the black folks. I've explained to my sergeant owned this place and invited his unit down for a beer and that these folks were part of the unit. No good, the bartender said. They should have known the invitation didn't include them. That, of course, set me off, and I was soon as persona non grata as my black friends. Out in the parking lot, I said, "Okay, where can we get a drink together?" Only to be told, "No place in this town." So they went to their bars, and Bob, Warren, and I went to ours. I was reluctant to say anything to my platoon sergeant. He was, after all, my superior. But 4 weeks later, after I was transferred to another unit, I was sitting in the bar with the book and the pitcher of beer, not an unusual sight, when Sergeant Jones came through the door. I waved him over to my table, poured him the beer, and told him the story. He said, "I feel terrible. I hate to cause anyone to be embarrassed." Great, he wouldn't let it happen again in his bar. But he added, "We really don't mix down here." I plunged right in. "What do you think of Sergeant Lowry, who is his black superior? He's a fine soldier and gentleman. Would you have a beer with him?" "I have in the NCO club. He's good company." Undaunted, and not knowing when to quit, I went on. "Would you have him to your house?" He looked at me as though I was bereft of my senses. "I have a wife and daughter." I had no idea what to say. I mumbled something, changed the subject, finished my beer, and went on my way. That was 46 years ago. Things have changed greatly. Barack Obama now commands the armed forces. But are we all different? I hope so. I mentioned listening to Ruthie Morrissey sing The Dying Rebel. I unfortunately don't have a copy of that here, but I do have the Wolf Tones doing it. Thank you. technology, some with both feet, some hardly at all. And there are some questions that have come along. Like, I happen to be on Facebook a lot. Some of the listeners aren't. But I want, this is called Life Coaches. I wanted through Facebook, now one of the largest countries in the world, and cannot believe how many people present themselves as life coaches. They will help you to manage your time, enjoy sex more, use makeup more professionally, speak like a pro in public, seduce the one you want, market your product like Apple Computer, become the millionaire from your home business. Do these people make a living? If so, why? There have been some errors that have been made, though, as we came down the pike in business. And I have another poem that I wrote based on my experience called Business Fables, which may or may not be true. Western Union told Bell, people won't want to talk over wires. IBM told Xerox, people don't make that many copies. Digital Equipment said that people won't want computers on their desks. A friend of mine's uncle chose to keep his deli instead of going into business with Tom Carvel. The friend of mine, given the chance to invest in the fledgling Apple Computer by Steve Jobs, chose to put the money instead into his eventually bankrupt computer store. So, Pilgrim, what don't you think people want? Some people say that everything is going to change. The science fiction writers have been way ahead of the game. Buck Rogers became Neil Armstrong after Flash Gordon became John Glenn. Isaac Asimov gave us the laws of robotics. Arthur C. Clarke put us into satellite communications. Bruce Sterling got us all wired up. William Gibson scared the hell out of us. And Neal Stephenson took us to the next level with Snow Crash. Get the picture? Science fiction leads us, charting our path. And now science fiction writers and one science futurist focus on singularity and post-human, the end of humanity as we know it. Chips will be implanted into us. Brains will be downloaded onto chips. And we will replace wetware of fragile bodies with synthetic material. So say Vinge, Kurzweil, and Rucker. Scared? Why? You won't be here to see it. I spent a good 5 years hanging out at a place, since I've lived up here in Jefferson Valley, at the place called Guinan's in Garrison. That place is no longer with us. I was introduced to it by a former guest on this show, Gwendolyn Bounds, who's now in charge of a video production for Consumer Report. She was previously a Wall Street Journal columnist. And I'm going to take you through two things there, one called Wendy's Book. My love affair with Guinan's began in my local Barnes & Noble, when my next-door neighbor, Lucille Evangelisti, handed me a book. I think you'll like this. The Little Chapel on the River by Gwendolyn Bounds. Gwendolyn Bounds? What kind of a name is that? I never knew any Gwendolyn's. It's growing up in Irish Inwood. It sounded English. Well, the book was about a country store / pub in Garrison, New York, called Guinan's after the owner, Jim, then became one of my all-time favorites. And I read a lot. Gwendolyn, now Wendy, became a friend, and Guinan's became part of my life. I brought the number of friends to Guinan's over the years, and most, while they liked the sandwiches and magnificent view of the beautiful Hudson River and West Point, never really got it. It's so crowded, you don't know most of these people. It was the joy of my inward youth, of the Broadstone, of the Good Shepherd Friday night dances, of the Colonial football games, of the 4th of July boat ride, of the mass of humanity packed into chambers, dancing and drinking. It was more than individual joy. It was a collective joy. Hell, I'm not explaining it very well. Read Wendy's book. And the poem was dedicated to Lucille Evangelisti. I did try to explain it. The big deal to Guinan's, other than just going up and hanging around and talking to interesting people, was something called Irish Night, or the Rising of the Moon. And during the summer, there were hundreds of people there to hear musicians who came from all over the Hudson Valley to play. Some on traditional instruments like guitars and keyboards, others on very strange instruments like bodhrams and spoons and triangles. And during the winter, we'd move into Jim Guinan's, into the bar and the store and Jim Guinan's house. And one November night, I spent all night trading basketball stories with George Pataki, who was the governor at the time. Excuse me. I lived up the hill. So, the name of the poem is The Communion of Saints. It's Irish Night at Guinan's, the first Thursday after the full moon, and the place is packed. And there's a harp and a bodhram and a few accordions and a whistle and a few guitars and a few fiddles and some singers and a lot of beer. There are some writers and plumbers and the governor with New York State Police Guard with him, and restaurateurs and real estate agents and professors and whoever else walks in. And there is much talk and gaiety until there is a hush. When Jim is ready to sing, I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen, and we all listen. Kelly's behind the bar, Jim's in the kitchen, and we all take turns putting money on the deli register. Talk abounds, laughter is king, joy reigns, and we are friends, but people we don't even know. And then it ends, and we all go home. We are the funny people. Well, Guinan's eventually died because first John Guinan, son of Jim, one of the strongest, nicest people that I've known, was hit with the grand mal seizure and then had four operations for brain tumors before he died. And there was no one really to run the bar. His daughter and the store. His daughter did it for a while, but she had a life. She was a graphic artist. And eventually, Jim moved to Florida, and it closed. And it's still closed. And Wendy and I talked about this on the radio show, if you're interested, you can listen just by going to my website. There are many people that may interest you. There was Al DiBello, the previous lieutenant governor of the state of New York. There's Colleen Rowley, who was an FBI whistleblower. There have been prosecutors there. There are many writers, and you may find that interesting. But Wendy was on, we talked about this. And then Jim died. Now, I used to, when I taught at Monroe College on some Thursday nights, when they would have this, I would, when it ended, jump on my motor scooter, and I'd go to 50 miles to Guinness just to participate in the end. Jim used to sing The Dying Rebel for me when I asked him to. So this was spring. Spring has finally come. I uncover my motor scooter, hit the starter, and it comes to life. It's spring, so I head for Guinness. Down the Taconic, across 202, along the Beaumont Parkway, up Route 9, on 403, closing in, passing the train station, over the tracks, right to the door. The building is empty. Jim is in Florida. John is dead. The Hudson is cold and choppy. I head for home. And then I went to his funeral. April 15th, 2009. At Jim Guinan's funeral in Cold Spring, New York, the church is packed with family and friends. The priest has 10 minutes in his homily to deal with Jim's 83 years on two continents, his marriage, his four children, his over 40 years as a bar owner and storekeeper. He also tries to bring condolence and inspiration to the packed church of family and friends. A heady task. Everyone will tell him that it was wonderful, just perfect. But was it? How could it be in 10 minutes? But it makes no difference anyhow. Those packed in the church have already made up their minds about Jim Guinan, or they wouldn't have been there. His smile, his joy, his willingness to share a tale, to sing a song. The smile he brought to my eyes when he said, "How are you, young fellow?" June was reminded us of our own mortality, and that's not always a happy thought. Hell, it never is. The grandmother of a friend of mine died in church. I guess there are worse ways to go. It must have scared the hell out of those around her. Then one last about guidance. Another full moon. The sky has been overcast, so I didn't notice it until I got out of the car at home. It was a full moon on a Thursday night. The rising of the moon at guidance. For 3 years, I would have been leaving school. I'm a college professor. Jumping in my car or my motor scooter. And then terrorizing to guidance to join a few hundred of my friends, some of whom I'd never met before, for the music, the laughs, the joy. Wendy, how's it going? How are you tonight, John? Jimmy, good to see you. Are you going to sing The Dying Rebel for me? Great. Governor, how's the jump shot? And so on. Now it is no more. John is dead, Jim is dead, and Guinan is no more. But every full moon Thursday, it is alive in my mind. I loved my mother dearly for 40 of her 79 years, but there is no one incident that hits me in the head every month to bring it to mind. Likewise, I think of my father on his birthday or on the anniversary of his untimely death, and sometimes even when the memory creeps in, but there is no monthly sledgehammer. Perhaps it's because the Guinan's experience is much more recent. Well, because I can feel my own mortality in John's and Jim's. Or perhaps it was pure joy. Shh, Jimmy's about to sing my song. And that song was The Dying Rebel, which I already played. Thanks to Credence for the second time tonight. Well, we're past an hour. It's obvious that Sarah's not going to be here. For those new to the show, this is the third time that this has happened in 69 shows. One of the time was with FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley, where she just forgot. And she was on later, and she more than made it up. But I want to thank people that hung in. I have one person has been there all the time from the 245 phone number, the 914 area code. Caller, are you there? I think in all probability it's one of the Bonners. Would you join us?
Yes, I'm here.
And I'm very sorry to disappoint you, because I know that you wanted to speak to Sarah.
I enjoyed your show, John. It was very interesting and very good.
Well, I hope so. I hope that you and others will join us next week for Joan Walsh, who I would expect to be here, since, as I said, it's been 3 out of 69, which is a pretty good average. And as they say after the Met win, where there aren't many, put it in the book. I hope that folks will go to my website, read my new newspaper, and send me any comments, and steady, Silver, steady. We'll see you all next week.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Bye. Come on, Silver, let's get out of here.